Once, many years ago, there was a man named Bronson Alcott. He lived in Massachusetts during the early 1800s. Today, he's best remembered as the father of Louisa May Alcott, who wrote the classic book, Little Women. But Bronson was notable in his own right. He was a transcendentalist, close friends with folks like Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau. Together, they were a group of people thinking differently about the world, beginning to ask questions and challenge the status quo. They were good Unitarians, after all. Bronson's niche among this group of free thinkers was as an educator. When he looked out and saw the classrooms of his day, he was uninspired. Rote memorization, drill and recitation style learning, a strict emphasis on harsh discipline. It was a system based on the belief that children were inherently devious and corrupt, and that a teacher's job was to control and subvert them through punishment or shame or fear. And this all deeply troubled Bronson. So he began to experiment with new ways of teaching. And so in 1834, he founded the Boston Temple School. This place was revolutionary. He threw out all the conventions of his day. Learning centered around discussion and questions and critical thinking. Children were encouraged to follow their intuition, to feel and think for themselves, engaging not only their minds, but their hearts and their character too. Perhaps most radical of all, corporal punishment and fear-based learning was banned. Students were even involved in deciding rules and then also punishments, the consequences for when they were broken. His daughter, Louisa May, would write that her father taught in the wise way that unfolds what lies in a child's nature, as a flower blooms. It was one of the first experiments in liberal arts education. The school was so progressive that it caught just about everyone's attention. Some loved what he was doing, seeing it as a promising model to be copied all across America. And some were appalled, believing it encouraged immorality and heresy and disbelief. A few months in, Bronson published a book to explain all of his ideas and to discuss and present them to the world that was all about talking about through his ideas. His book was well-intentioned, and it hit a nerve with his critics. Most controversial was the section on the benefits of honest conversation with his students, specifically around issues of childbirth and circumcision. Bronson was hinting at a kind of 19th century sex education. This, as we know, is not an easy conversation in our time, and you can imagine it caused quite a stir back then. One prominent Unitarian and Harvard professor called the book one-third blasphemy, one-third obscenity, and the rest nonsense. Another writer derided Bronson as either being insane or half-witted. All this negative press sunk his book. It sold so poorly that one Boston lawyer actually bought 750 copies just to use as waste paper. And the thing is, Bronson should have seen it coming. Several of his close friends and even teachers in his school warned him against publishing it, and especially to remove those more controversial sections. They thought he was going too far and too fast, and that his work would be discredited. But Bronson had, of course, refused, believing that his ideas were too important and he shouldn't be bullied in expressing them. There was too much at stake, he thought, for those ideas to take a back seat to political expediency. He trusted in the goodness of his children and the righteousness of his cause, and thought it would be better for people to wrestle with the truth than to remain stuck in backwards thinking. For Bronson, it was simply the right thing to do. Bronson's friends were right, at least, in predicting trouble. Beyond the myriad of criticisms he received in the press, many parents of his students were also quite upset. They began pulling their children out of his school, taking much of his funding. But Bronson remained unbowed. Classes continued with fewer students, and the school carried along. But it didn't take long for Bronson to cause waves again. He had the opportunity to admit a student of color. Like before, his friends and fellow educators warned him against such a provocative move. But again, he was steadfast in his principles and welcomed the child anyways. He argued he could do nothing less. If he really believed in the inherent goodness of all children and that quality education should be available for everyone. And this time, there was an even louder uproar, more angry than the first. The last of his families withdrew their students. With his reputation tarnished, the school out of money and out of children, Bronson closed down. His grand experiment ended. What do we make of this story of Bronson and his school? It's hard not to admire his courage and his passion. Here was a man who remained steadfast in his principles, who did what was right even when no one else would support him. No one could bully or intimidate Bronson. But at the same time, we also see how those wonderful qualities got him into trouble and then ended his dream. We can imagine how this felt for him. Grief and hurt at being attacked so meanly in the press. Abandonment by the people and parents who had previously believed in him. And then disappointment at watching it all fall apart. Doing the right thing and living with integrity can be painful. We make decisions we know will hurt us because we feel that our hearts or our convictions allow us no other options. And what makes Alcott's story so difficult is that the failure he experienced was not just a personal one. It was also a failure for his cause, for those very values he cared so much about. And it was brought on because he acted with integrity. In doing the right thing, in writing about talking honestly with children, and in integrating his school, he ultimately, it seemed, undermined his own noble purpose. So the question I struggle with is this: did Bronson actually do the right thing? On one hand, he acted on his values. On the other hand, those values undercut his vitally important work. Was that sacrifice worth it? I think we can all agree from where we are today that Bronson was a man of deep principle and character, and that the virtues he stood for across the board were good ones. And we can imagine his dilemma, either to take the safe path but do what feels morally questionable, even cowardly, or go ahead anyways and take the risk and hope for the best. Of course, he didn't know what would happen, but his friends seemed pretty sure. They were not unreasonable people either. Many were radical folks in their own right, committed to causes of equality and human dignity and upending the status quo. Most were early feminists, women who themselves were engaged in a fierce battle for inclusion and dignity and respect. Certainly sympathetic and good people. If we could ask them today, I wonder how they would explain their advice to Bronson. Maybe they would say they were just more politically savvy than he was, and he might have been slightly naive. Maybe they worried for their friend and didn't want him to experience suffering or failure. Or maybe they would say they held a different understanding of what integrity was. Despite my deep admiration for Bronson, I can see a little bit of the wisdom of his friends. Sometimes when we are engaged with full hearts and passion for something we believe in, it appears we face only two paths and two choices. One means doing the right thing, the other the wrong thing. And given those choices, no matter what the consequence, we will feel we'll have to do the right one. It's easy to see our choices that way, but life is rarely full of them, these black and white choices, if we really think about it. Our world is too complicated. Did Bronson do right or wrong? I'm not sure. But I do worry that his view of integrity, of what it meant to be and do right or do wrong, was too narrow. It was almost as if he believed that either you go ahead full force or you aren't going ahead at all. That only one battle wins the war. And that's not true. And I think it's too simplistic. It's one thing to do the right thing. Life is full of opportunities to do that. Bronson certainly had the right values. But if we want to change the world as well, if we want to succeed instead of fail, we need something else. We need wisdom. We need to be smart about how we want to change the world. This is the week we celebrate Martin Luther King Jr. Day, a holiday designed to honor the civil rights movement and its leaders. And what I think made Martin Luther King and folks like Rosa Parks special was not simply their values or their awareness of society's deep injustice. Lots of people during that time shared their values. They knew those problems existed and had been working on them for years. What made MLK and Rosa Parks and folks like them special was they had figured out a way to actually make change happen. They were smart about their work. They engineered a movement not only based on the right thing, but on what got the job done. They chose their battles. They implemented a strategy. That's why Rosa Parks didn't protest every time she took the bus. She did it when it really mattered. She took the wider view. She was deliberate and effective and wise. It paid off, and it changed the world. Living with integrity in this way is not easy, because wisdom and thoughtfulness and intentionality take work and even sacrifice. They force us to face morally nebulous situations and refrain from doing some good in the moment in order that some larger good will be seen and preserved and accomplished. Real integrity means accepting with courage and responsibility facing these complexities and difficult choices. It means going on beyond just right intention. It's about making sure your intentions and your actions actually make a difference. That's harder, but that's real integrity. It's right intention plus wisdom. We need both. In the Christian New Testament, even Jesus himself talks about this. He recognizes the messed up nature of the world we live in, and he's talking to his disciples. "Behold," he says, "I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves." But he says, and he reassures them, that you virtuous sheep are not helpless, and suggests that they be doers, that in order to be doers of good and speakers of truth, they must also be two things. He says, "Be as shrewd as serpents and as innocent as doves. It's Jesus' way of telling his followers to keep their values, but be wise about them. Stay true to who you are, but think. That's how you make a difference. I think this is a worthy goal for Unitarian Universalists, because there is still a lot of work to do. We only need to read the paper or go online to witness the need for more people to act on their values, but also to act wisely. And churches like ours have a big part to play. When I was in divinity school, I worked at our denominational headquarters with a department called the Office of Congregational Advocacy and Witness. I was just a lowly intern, crammed into a tiny little office, but the work I was doing was something I found very exciting. I got to talk to congregations all over the country, those congregations that had been identified as doing the best and most effective social justice work in our denomination. And I found real and consistent patterns for what was making these communities successful. You could write a book on each of their practices. They formed strong community partnerships. They focused attention and energy on only one or two projects. Their justice work was not just about one committed committee or a few committed individuals, but the whole congregation. And they always stayed hopeful and believed that what they did mattered. Unfortunately, like Bronson, most of our congregations don't practice social justice this way. And that's too bad, because it means we don't make an impact. It's the way we change the world if we follow these practices, these tried and true ways. Most of our congregations are led, and our social justice committees are led, by a few dedicated individuals who work on a committee isolated from the heart of the church. These folks have their particular passions and their projects that they run well and effectively, but often are unconnected and unknown. And charity is emphasized instead of systematic change. So here's my challenge to you. I'm a newcomer to this congregation. I've been here since September. I'm not all familiar with all the work that we do here. But I hope you'll accept this challenge to follow the advice that Jesus laid out to be snakes and doves, to find in your heart the spirit of innocence, but don't use it as an excuse to be reckless or duck responsibilities for hard or even painful work. To admire Bronson's passion, to know what causes your heart to sing, but to remember MLK and Rosa Parks too, and what made them different. Unitarian Universalism, this congregation, needs your wisdom. And the world does too, all you good-hearted, caring, lovely people. It's the only way anything will change for the better, when people plant seeds of kindness and hope, and then do the hard work to care for them tenderly and not stop until they bloom. This love, this courage, our shared hearts make all the difference. So get out your rake and your gardening gloves. Bring out your water bucket and your shovel, and let's see what we can grow. Amen. I invite you now to rise in body or in spirit for our final hymn, number 121, We'll Build a Land.